Daniel chapter 1, starting at verse 1. It says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem, and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. And the king spoke unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, and of the king's seed, and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well-favored, and skillful in all wisdom, and cunning in knowledge, and understanding in science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, whom they might teach the learning and tongue of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. Now among these were of the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names. He gave unto Daniel the name of Belteshazzar, to Hananiah of Shadrach, and to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. And the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your meat and drink. For why should he see your faces worse liking than the children which are of your sort? Then shall you make me endanger my head to the king. Then said Daniel to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, prove your servants, I beseech you, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. Then let our countenance be looked upon before thee, and the countenance of the children that eat the portion of the king's meat, and as you see, deal with your servants. So he consented to them in this matter, and proved them 10 days, and at the end of 10 days, their countenance appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. Thus Melzar took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink, and gave them pulse. And as for these 4 children, God gave them knowledge and skill and all learning and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now the end of the days that the king had said he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king communed with them. And among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in his realm. And Daniel continued even into the first year of King Cyrus. The first 2 verses of the book of Daniel put the entire account into historical and theological context. The first verse gives the history. After defeating the Assyrian and Egyptian armies at the Battle of Carchemish, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, starts to bring his army down toward Egypt. And in his way is this little nation of Judah, having just lost Josiah, the greatest king since David. The nation is on the verge of ruin. It is a pitiful excuse for a king. A man named Jehoiakim has been installed on the throne after he essentially promised to be a lackey for Egypt, sending them payments of tribute every year. So the kingdom of Judah is failing economically. It's being drained of its wealth by Egypt. It's failing militarily. It's entirely outmatched by the mighty empires gathering on its borders. Most importantly, the kingdom is failing spiritually. They had utterly abandoned the worship of Yahweh, who is their only source of strength and protection. That spiritual failure is ultimately addressed in verse 2. Verse 2 says, "And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar." Those stone walls of Judah could not protect Judah's king. Only Yahweh is a fortress that's strong enough for times of trouble. Yet Nebuchadnezzar's military might is not strong enough to defeat this little kingdom of Judah unless God himself gives them the victory. That's the theological theme of the book of Daniel. God is sovereign. It could not be more clear that God is sovereign and all-powerful than if in verse 2, a visible hand from heaven reached down and plucked Jehoiakim off of the throne of Judah and took him outside the walls and dropped him alone in front of the Babylonian army. God gave Jehoiakim to Nebuchadnezzar. Listen, the throne of Judah is God's to give. We're going to find out later on that the throne of Babylon in some distant kingdom is God's to give. And while we're at it, let's just be clear that the Oval Office is God's to give. Y'all, there will never be an individual sitting behind the Resolute desk in the White House except that God has placed them there for his own glorious purposes. Now, the purposes of God are sometimes mysterious to us. I'm certain that the people of Judah may have wondered why the same God who had protected them years before against a Syrian onslaught, now Yahweh hands the victory over to the Babylonians. Yet they'd had plenty of resources to figure out why God would do this. God had warned for generations that disobedience would bring disaster, and now he's simply enforcing his word. God is not obligated to reward unrighteousness in people. Now, in Daniel 1, there's actually in this chapter no hint of why it is that God has done this. Hopefully you learned that from the history last week. And by the time we get to Daniel 9, we're going to see the prophet Daniel himself understands that this is a sign of judgment against Judah's disobedience. They have been chasing after other gods, and it is as if Yahweh finally said, "Well, since you keep going off after other gods, I'll just make it easy for you. I'm going to bring them over to you." Daniel's not just about God's sovereignty in giving Judah to Babylon. If you're a note taker in your Bible, I want you to circle that word "gave" in verse 2. Let me show you a couple other places where it shows up in this chapter. It's the Hebrew word natan, which means to give or to allow or to place, to cause something. In verse 2, God gave Jehoiakim into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. In verse 9, where it says God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs, that's actually the same word there. Natan, God gave or placed kindness and compassion for Daniel in the heart of that overseer. In verse 17, you find it again where it says God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. Get this into your mind from the very beginning of this book. Wherever you go, God is in control. Y'all, our God is large and in charge. The battle between kings and armies is God's to give. Compassion and kindness in the heart of an enemy bureaucrat is God's to give. Understanding and wisdom in God's own people is his to give. God is all powerful in all places. He determines the course of empires. He sets the affections of your heart. God is at this very moment firing every synapse in your brain that's allowing you to understand the words that I'm speaking. God is the one who is in control. So if God is in such control, we might ask ourselves, why would he allow himself to suffer this apparent embarrassment? In the eyes of the world, the ancient Far East mainstream media would have treated this as a defeat for Yahweh. They believed that when a nation went to war, when people lost the battle, it was because their God wasn't strong enough to protect them. And in this case, Yahweh appears in the minds of the Babylonians and probably in the minds of many Jews to be unable to protect Judah. And the embarrassment is complete in verse 2 when the treasures of God's temple are carried away and put into service to the false gods of Babylon. God allowed another similar defeat to this in the past. In 1 Samuel 5, the Philistines came and they won a battle and they carried off the Ark of God's covenant. And they took it back to Philistia and they set it in front of the big idol of their god, Dagon. It was a symbol of their victory over Yahweh. Of course, when they woke up the next morning and looked, the statue of Dagon had fallen on its face before the Ark of the Covenant, and its head and its hands were cut off. A statement that God is the God of Israel, and he's the God in Philistia. He is the God of all creation. These treasured temple vessels that are carried away are going to tell a similar story. It's not just some treasure and pride. Those vessels are mentioned so that we look backward and we look forward in this story. If you remember last week, we looked at God's words to King Hezekiah about 120 years earlier. He showed all the temple vessels to the ambassadors of Babylon. In Isaiah 39, verses 5 through 7, it says, Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days come that all that's in your house and all what your fathers have laid up in store unto this day will be carried away to Babylon. There shall be nothing left, says the Lord. And of your sons that shall issue from you, which you shall beget, shall they take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." And so here, Nebuchadnezzar is victorious, but it is fulfilling God's word to Hezekiah that those vessels are going to be carried away to Babylon. And that Hezekiah's own descendants are going to be carried away and made eunuchs in Babylon. These vessels mentioned in verse 2, they are not symbolic of God losing control. They show that God is in control. But they're also mentioned in order to foreshadow later in Daniel's story. When you get to Daniel chapter 5, you're going to see those vessels again. They are brought out at a drunken party and they're placed into the hands of a doomed Babylonian king. When the writing is literally on the wall that God is about to give that king over into the hands of his enemies. That's all set up in the first two verses. This is front-loaded suspense, foreshadowing the rest of the book. Starting in verse 3, we find the Babylonians were not content just carrying off treasured items. They also carried off treasured people. In order to ensure that Judah would send its annual tribute payments to Babylon, a handful of royal children were taken. They would become hostages in a foreign land. They would serve as a tool for Babylonian propaganda. We're told about them in verse 6, the main character of the book, Daniel, and his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Now I said in your handout, it was going to be a too long introduction. Well, the introduction's over. So let's jump into the story of these four young men and see them in verse 3 through 7 serving in Babylon. It says in verse 3 through 7, the king spoke to Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel unto the king's seed and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well-favored, skillful in all wisdom, cunning in knowledge, understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and tongue of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end of 3 years they might stand before the king. Now among these were children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names, for he gave to Daniel the name Belteshazzar, and to Hananiah Shadrach, and to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. Daniel and these three friends of his of royal birth, they're descendants of the kings of Judah. They're smart. They've been educated in preparation for serving the court of Judah. They're deemed able to learn new languages and the history of the Chaldeans. They are attractive, it says in verse 4, no blemish, worthy to stand in the court of Babylon. Each of them was also a child of God. It's reflected in the names that were given to them at birth. Hebrew tradition in religious families was to include God's name Yahweh, or Elohim, the more general term for God, in a name. And you can hear that in their names. You can hear Daniel, Elohim, El, Mishael. You can hear Yahweh, Hananiah, Azariah. Their names are, Daniel's name is God is my judge. Hananiah's name is Yahweh is gracious. Mishael's name is who is like God. And Azariah's name is Yahweh is my help. Now we don't know exactly the age of these prized princes of Judah. In verse 4, it uses the term children, but that word in Hebrew can mean anything up to a young adult. They are possibly preteens, but more likely they are in their mid-teens. When you see how long Daniel lives after this, we're going to assume he's probably around 15 or 16 years old at this point. We do know that as soon as they were taken, a reprogramming plan was put into effect. Their whole worlds get turned upside down. Nebuchadnezzar's intention was not merely to keep them as hostages against Judah, but to turn them into weapons to use against their own nation. All of their Jewishness was going to be driven from them. I want you to think of four ways this reprogramming plan worked. First, it worked by mutilation. It is difficult to imagine, to the point that many people don't want to accept it as true, that these four Hebrew boys were most certainly put into chains and forced down squirming and screaming while they were castrated. Nothing in the text specifically records this, but it's implicit in the details. In verse 3, they are put into the charge of Ashpenaz, who is seven times in this chapter called the master of the eunuchs. That in itself could be enough to convince us, but add to that, what was God's warning to Hezekiah 120 years earlier? All that treasure is going to be carried away, and some of your descendants are going to be taken away to Babylon to be eunuchs. It was common for slaves in royal courts to be made eunuchs in order to, you know, keep them from the temptation of the king's harem, but also to give them a single-minded sense of purpose. When this happened, any hope that they had and plans for their future was immediately stolen from them. Their bodies belong to Babylon. Their future belongs to Babylon. Their minds, we're about to see, belong to Babylon. And yet, Daniel and Mishael and Azariah and Hananiah are not as easily emasculated as their captors seem to believe. They're going to prove their manhood by service. They're going to stand defiantly before kings when it's required. So this reprogramming included mutilation, but it also included isolation. These boys are prisoners. They are alone. Look, they don't get to Snapchat with their friends. They don't get to have a Zoom meeting with mom and dad back home in Jerusalem. They're removed from everything that they've ever known, and they've entered into this re-education program, and they're not going to see the light of day from this program for 3 years. And at that time, they'll be brought before the king with the understanding that Nebuchadnezzar would then decide whether their lives had any use for him. The third way, during these 3 years, they undergo indoctrination. Look again at verse 4. They're going to be taught the learning and tongue of the Chaldeans. The language of Babylon was two languages, Aramaic and Akkadian. They're going to learn both of those languages in addition to their native Hebrew. And that word learning there has the idea of a thing that is written. So Daniel woke up every day for 3 years and essentially was sent to the University of Babylon, right? Here's your class schedule. The Babylonian language, another Babylonian language, Babylonian history, Babylonian literature and poetry, economics, math, myths, religious training. You understand, the idea was not just to remove them from their Hebrew culture, it was to shove the culture of Babylon down their throats. The fourth tool for their reprogramming was assimilation. Every day they faced the challenge of, why don't you just give up and be one of us? Wouldn't it be easier? Give up who you are and who you want to be. Even their names are taken from them in verse 7. They're assigned new names, and not names that are meant to sound more Babylonian, but names that are meant to be in open repudiation against their God Yahweh. When these boys were infants, their parents delighted in the hope for their future. They were each given a name to honor Yahweh, but now those names are forbidden. And each of them is assigned a new title to honor one of the Babylonian gods, either Bel or Nebo or Aku. Daniel, God is my judge, is given the name Belteshazzar. Bel protects him. Hananiah, whose name is Yahweh is gracious, is changed to Shadrach, commanded by Aku, the moon god. Mishael, who is like God, his name is changed to Meshach, who is like Aku. And Azariah, Yahweh is my help, is now called Abednego, the servant of Nebo. They heard these names every day, pounding like a hammer into their hearts. And yet, Babylon is a society that is not only compelling in its cruelty, but it's also seductive in its luxury. So each of them, as they're called by these names honoring false gods, they are put into luxurious clothes. They're set at tables of exquisite cuisine. Verse 8 says they're given the king's meat and the king's wine. They were fed meals fit for a king. Can you just hear it? Come on, Belteshazzar. Come on, Shadrach, Meshach. It's mealtime, Abednego. How easy would it be for you to give up your Hebrewness and just enjoy the luxuries of Babylon? This is psychological warfare. Every attempt is made to ensure that they are mutilated, isolated, indoctrinated, assimilated. Here's this handful of Hebrew teens who are taken away from their homes. They're dragged off to Babylon. They're under the charge of a Babylonian official. They're sent to Babylonian school to learn Babylonian language and Babylonian history. And they're given Babylonian names, dressed in Babylonian clothes, fed Babylonian food, all with the intention that they would stop being who they are and serve in the courts of Babylon. And there is little that they can do to control any of that. They only had control over themselves in the battle for their heart. They would not betray their people. They would not reject their God. They would not surrender their souls to Babylon. And so they're serving in Babylon, but they're also surviving in Babylon. Look at verses 8 through 16. Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs, and the prince of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king has appointed your meat and your drink, for why should he see your faces worse like than the children which are of your sort? Then you shall make me endanger my head to the king. Then said Daniel to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, prove your servants, I beseech you, 10 days. Let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. Then let our countenance be looked upon before you, and the countenance of the children that eat the portion of the king's meat. And as you see, deal with your servants. So he consented to them in this matter and proved them 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their countenance appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. Thus Melzar took away the portion of their meat and the wine which they should drink and gave them pulse. Let me just say first, when you grab some portion of God's word and you remove it from its context, strange things start to happen. There's entire books written about the Daniel diet or the Daniel plan. Like, the purpose of these verses is to give some dietary instructions to God's people. This is not here to give you a superior dieting plan. The diet Daniel asks for is clearly inferior, and that's the point. It's not exactly clear what Daniel thought would be particularly defiling about the king's food. There's a few possibilities. He may have been motivated by Jewish dietary laws, right? If the king's meat was pork, for example, that's forbidden in the law of Moses for Jews to eat. But there's nothing in the law of Moses that forbids the drinking of wine, and Daniel also considers that defiling. So dietary laws are only a partial explanation for this at best. Maybe he wanted to refrain from eating food that had been offered to idols. And certainly the New Testament tells us that an idol is nothing and it can't taint food, but Daniel's not a New Testament saint. He and his friends would be appalled to eat meat that had been sacrificed to one of these Babylonian gods. But the text doesn't specify that's what's happening, so that's just speculation. It may be that Daniel saw this defilement as symbolic. Refusing the king's food, as he was doing that, he was refusing to agree that Nebuchadnezzar was the source of his life. They would flourish only by Yahweh to his glory. Finally, I think it's possible and very likely that Daniel and his friends simply saw this as resistance to the reprogramming of Babylon. Listen, you can call us the names that you want and we can't change that. We're going to wear the clothes that you give us and we're going to learn in your schools, but you cannot make us enjoy this. And by asserting some area of political resistance, these boys allowed a way to remind themselves several times each day of exactly who they really are, even as that's being tried to take away from them. I think it's important to see Daniel's wisdom as he engages in this political dissent. He doesn't throw a fit. He doesn't organize protests. He doesn't stomp his feet in the unfairness of it all. He approaches this issue with wisdom and composure. First, in verse 9, he asks Ashpenaz, the chief of the eunuchs, whom God had given, it says, favor and tender love toward Daniel. Those words probably are better translated kindness and compassion, or favor and goodwill. But Ashpenaz says no. He rebuffs this plan. Ashpenaz points out to Daniel, look, man, if this doesn't work, the king's going to cut my head off, not yours. And so instead, Daniel goes and talks to Melzar. He says, let's just try this out for 10 days. Verse 12. Let's just try it out for 10 days. It'll be a good test. Give us pulse and water. That word pulse, by the way, is just a word meaning anything that grows from a seed. Essentially, give us vegetables and water instead of meat and wine. So here's where I get to address the kids out there, right? Eat your vegetables to the glory of God. Too much? Well, it makes about as much sense as a Daniel diet for your whole life. Now, Melzar agrees to this plan, maybe because in the scheme of a three-year plan, 10 days is not a great issue. It's worth the trial. It's also possible that Melzar agrees to this plan because he has something to gain from it. Right? Hey, man, keep bringing us the plates. You eat our steak, we'll eat your asparagus. It's not the worst deal he could have made. And yet God blesses them for the effort. Verse 15, it says they were fairer and fatter in flesh. That is, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the other captives. And there were other captives, by the way. Judah was not the only nation that got ground under the chariots of Babylon. Those other captives go about assimilating into Babylonian culture, but Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah silently resist, and God blesses them for it. But that fits into the context of the book, right? God is sovereign. God is sovereign in all things, in all places. He is sovereign over things as great as kings and rising of the and falling of empires. And he is sovereign in all places, even working his will in the digestive system of a handful of teenage boys in foreign captivity. So we've seen them serving in Babylon, surviving in Babylon. Finally, look at verses 17 through 21. Where they're succeeding in Babylon. It says, as for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill and all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days that the king had said he should bring them in, the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king communed with them, he spoke with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king, and in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in his realm. And Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. These verses give us sort of the rest of the story. We know there's plenty more story to tell after this. That's coming in the next chapters. For example, verse 17 foreshadows Daniel chapter 2. It says that God gave Daniel understanding and visions and dreams. We get over to the next chapter. King Nebuchadnezzar is about to dream some of the dreamiest dreams you're ever going to hear of. Because of God, they grew strong on their diet of veggie burgers. I don't know how. Because of God, they graduated from the University of Babylon at the top of their class. How well did Daniel do in learning? Well, I said last week, chapters 2 through 7 are actually written in Aramaic, the language of Babylon. It's those things that the people of Babylon need to know and understand. Because of God, they stood before Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 20 says, he recognizes that they are 10 times wiser than all of the professional magicians and astrologers and wise men in his entourage. But listen, can I just point out to you how it is that they stood before Nebuchadnezzar? Look at verse 19. Listen, I don't know what names were announced when they completed their graduation ceremony. But I'm telling you, the young men who stood before King Nebuchadnezzar were not standing there as shining tributes of false gods of Babylon. Verse 19 tells us that those boys who struggled not to lose themselves did not lose themselves. After 3 years, Daniel is still Daniel, standing before this pagan king of Babylon, were four young men of courage named, God is my judge, Yahweh is gracious, who is like God, Yahweh is my help. Babylon carried these four young men into captivity, and they were fed their Babylonian food and dressed in Babylonian clothes and given their Babylonian names and schooled in Babylonian history. And at the end of it all, the king as confident Hebrews, servants of the Most High God. God blessed Daniel and preserved him. God used Daniel not for the glory of Daniel, but for the glory of God. Right? Daniel's going to be an example to the other Hebrew slaves. Remember, Ezekiel the prophet is a slave in Babylon living down by the river, and he keeps pointing to Daniel and his righteousness. The day is coming where all the slaves who are in Babylonian captivity are looking to Daniel as an example of obedience. He's a witness against God's judgment against Babylon. Daniel's going to stand before kings and declare God's word and watch them tremble. He's going to be an influence on King Cyrus. Cyrus is mentioned in verse 21. The very king who will eventually allow the Hebrews to return and go home and rebuild. Daniel's an influence on that man. If you wonder how far Daniel's influence travels, well, look, eventually when the New Testament opens, with the birth of Jesus, we see wise men from the east, from the direction of Babylon, and they're coming to worship King Jesus. I think it's very likely that's because they read what Daniel wrote down and they understood what he was saying. In fact, verse 21 may be my favorite verse of the whole chapter. It seems insignificant at first. It just says in verse 21, Daniel continued even to the first year of King Cyrus. But I want to make sure you understand what that's saying. Nebuchadnezzar is king of Babylon, right? You might want to circle that name Cyrus in verse 21. Cyrus is king of Persia, who conquers Babylon. So what verse 21 is telling us, for all of Babylon's efforts to remove God from the heart of Daniel, to steal from Daniel the very essence of himself, 67 years later, the mighty empire of Babylon has fallen, and when the dust from Babylon's collapse clears, Daniel is still standing there. Now, y'all, that's an exciting story, but what does it mean for us? Because if we approach Daniel too simplistically, like we do many stories of the Old Testament, we'll reduce it to moralism. Essentially, we'll say, well, you need to dare to be Daniel. Listen, do you really want to be Daniel? His family killed, his nation burned, mutilated, chained, future stolen from you, no hope of ever going back, and he never does get to go back. I want you to maybe adjust your thinking about Daniel chapter 1, because we think from verses 1 and 2, this is the story about Babylon invading Judah, and the aftermath of that invasion is a bunch of stuff and a bunch of citizens are hauled off. But the point of this story is not historical. The point is theological. It's not a story about how Babylon invaded Judah. I'm telling you, Daniel chapter 1 is a story about how God has invaded Babylon. I know it does not look that way at first. I mean, there's no thunderous sound of a marching army. Nobody's going to cower threatened before four unarmed captive teenagers. But this is an invasion nonetheless. God's word is going to be declared in the courts of Babylon. Here in this chapter, they're saying, we're not going to abandon God and sink into the wickedness of your culture. The three friends of Daniel are going to serve the king faithfully. But when he goes too far, you know the story. They defy his order to bow down to the idol that he makes. Daniel is going to stand before Nebuchadnezzar, and he's going to say, look, there is a God in heaven, and it is Yahweh who controls the nation, not you. Daniel's been dragged from his own ruined kingdom and placed into this wicked, worldly kingdom, and he gets visions at the end of God's coming kingdom. And for all he goes through, he can say to Nebuchadnezzar, I might be your slave now, but Yahweh has claimed me as his son forever. This is spiritual warfare, and Daniel's God-centered worldview is at odds with those surrounding him, especially those who are in control of the nation at the highest levels. Listen, since I don't know if you're in your car amening or nodding your head, I'm going to repeat that so maybe it sinks in and sounds familiar. Daniel's God-centered worldview is at odds with those surrounding him, especially those who are in control of the nation at its highest levels. That tension is going to do nothing but grow as the book goes on. Now let me insert here something of a side note. And look, I am talking specifically to those of you who are teenagers or who are about to become teenagers. Do not think for a moment that what you believe and how you behave don't matter. God is ready, willing, and able to use this moment of your life for eternal consequences. You don't have to be handed a loaded gun or a sword and shoved out in the world in order to be a warrior. Just stand with wisdom and composure and defiance against an ungodly world that wants to assimilate you into itself. Wants to absorb all of the righteousness from you until there's nothing left. You stand against it, and God can use that loving rebellion to make nations tremble for his glory. Listen, if you sink into the culture of this world, you will never be exceptional. In the next chapter, Nebuchadnezzar is going to have a dream, and all of the professional counselors, all of the Daniel's classmates who got all that Babylonian wisdom, they cannot help the king understand. Daniel comes and helps the king understand, but how does he do that? Does Daniel come in all of the wisdom he learned at the University of Babylon? No, what makes him exceptional is that he comes with something more than everyone else has to offer. He comes saying, look, there is a God in heaven. If you are a young disciple of Jesus, please learn this from Daniel. God's people do not need what the world has to offer. The world needs what God's people has to offer. The meaning of this story for us is to live up to our own calling as servants of God in whatever culture he has handed us over to in his divine plan. The end of this book of Daniel anticipates and predicts the coming of Jesus to conquer all the kingdoms of the world. And when Jesus came, he brings salvation through faith in his work. He sends his disciples out into the world to bring the gospel to what? All nations, all kinds of people, God has invaded all of the Babylons of the world. This is a story which anticipates New Testament saints showing us how to live counterculturally in whatever Babylon we find ourselves. A good understanding of the book of Daniel is going to show us how to approach our calling in wisdom and confidence. And the way we do that, on one extreme, we are not called to escapism and being hermits and being loners. We're called to make ourselves silent and invisible. That's not our calling. And on the other extreme, we are not called to sink into the culture of our world around us in the process of trying to be Jesus' disciples, looking nothing like Jesus himself. Our calling is to serve and survive and succeed in whatever modern Babylon God has placed us. Because long after the kingdoms of this world has fallen, we will find ourselves as servants of King Jesus in a kingdom that will never fail.